So, hello and welcome to the In the Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
I'm me, Josh Hughes.
In this episode, we're going to chat about 2019 in review. A year in review, Josh.
Yeah, so we've picked out a few major things that have sort of happened this year. Most of them, I think, I'd actually forgot had happened. Everything happens so fast these days that you kind of forget what happened. Well, last
because
week, never
mind. It's the news, it's the news culture, isn't it? So, moving on quickly. So, one thing always has to become the next thing. Obviously, we've got the big things that I think most people will be aware of. So, in politics, we've got the Brexit debacle.
Absolutely.
We've got our friend Mr. Trump in the United States. Some political unrest going on
around the world. Yeah, sort of a general rise in authoritarianism or
extreme views.
Being soft on authoritarianism as well.
Yeah, and not standing up to it, perhaps in its many guises.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so should we talk a little bit about that first before we move on to
talk about that, So I suppose obviously when it comes to sort of rising authoritarianism or being soft on it, people obviously the first thing to think about is Trump or these days. But actually that's not really the whole story because certainly Farage and Johnson in Britain have been a bit soft on it and flirted with authoritarian ideas, you know, calling the Remainers sort of traitors and that type of thing. That's sort of a clear dog whistle towards sort of more authoritarian ideas. Obviously,
but I mean, it goes the other way as well, doesn't it? Because you could say, well, the Brexiteer has been referred to as being racist, so everyone that wants to leave the EU is by definition therefore a racist. Are we talking then, is that maybe the language of sort of strong political language on either ends of things, maybe insightful political language?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's insightful.
Well, insightful with a C, as in insight.
Oh, inciting. Oh, inciting, right. Yes. No, I see.
Not insightful as in interesting. insightful as in with a C, insight.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. But I mean, I feel like, yeah, so I suppose it kind of, in the culture these days, there's kind of a thing of being unable to deal with opposing views, isn't there?
Mm.
In that, you know, there must be something wrong with you to disagree with me.
Yeah, I mean, this ties in with the conversations we've had on previous podcasts about social media and the internet, and the idea that you have a right to have a view and that your view is right.
It's apparently equal to everybody else's.
Yeah.
Even if you're not an expert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're also just presented with views that agree with you when you go onto these things, even sort of Google search engines. It's designed to confirm your own views.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is that if you, in any way, flirt with an extreme idea, kind of the way that lots of these algorithms work, they pick up lots of these algorithms on social media can kind of pick up on the or what should I say, take note, if you will, of the more extreme views because they're clear, so it's easy for the algorithms to quote unquote understand. Whereas a more moderate view that's balanced and nuanced, it's difficult for an algorithm to say this is what it is to quote unquote understand. Whereas if you sort of flirt with a more extreme idea, because the algorithms can recognize them more easily, then that can quite easily lead to an echo chamber.
I mean, that also ties in with the way that we interact with these things online in itself, because basically we don't read so much, we don't read so well. It's all about the headlines these days. It's not so much about the actual content underneath the headlines.
Yeah, and I suppose, and that leads us quite nicely to kind of ideas of post-truth or just blatant lying. So, I mean, the most obvious examples for us would be, you know, Trump and Johnson and Farage. But, I mean, you also see it in Russia with Putin, in India with Modi, and in Brazil with Bolsonaro, quite obviously. In addition to kind of all the other kind of pre-existing kind of authoritarian regimes that don't make the news sort of in Central Asia and the Middle East. So it's the idea of simply lying to people has sort of seemingly become normalised in a very dangerous way, I think.
Yeah, or we just, either we accept everything blindly or we don't accept anything at all, in which case it becomes hard to see through it all, doesn't it?
Exactly, and I think I saw some data the other day about sort of the UK election and how people basically have no trust in politicians. I'm like, well, that's so obvious if you think that they all lie. Because why would you trust someone if you assume that they're a liar?
Yeah.
despite the fact that the data kind of suggests that actually most of the policies that are put in manifestos, when a government gets voted in, most of those policies get carried out. So on most of the time, they do what they promise.
Yeah, but there is a problem there, I suppose, underpinning all that, the problem with the actual UK political system and the way it represents voters' opinions, but also the way that actually things can't really get done when you have this weird sort of situation, I mean, that we've had recently where basically you've got the Conservatives in power, but they don't really have any power to actually do anything, which grinds to a halt, and therefore people will obviously feel disappointed because even if they're promised something, that promise could never possibly become true because you've got people playing political ping pong with...
I suppose maybe this perhaps links into ideas of wanting authoritarianism, because if all you see is paralysis and nothing really happening from, you know, the legislative branch or the executive branch, and it kind of becomes quite easy to think, oh well, if someone just turned up and took power, then, you know, things would get done.
Yeah,
and everybody kind of hopes it's someone who agrees with them.
Yeah, and strong language is sort of what, almost as you say, what's driving this, really, because people want some sort of vision and clear idea of where we're going, which I suppose is why Trump has been so successful in attracting a certain number of voters to his way of thinking, even though what he says is rubbish half the time. I think some people quite like that.
Well, yeah, because I think it's kind of... I remember thinking sort of during his election, or the election campaign, and even during his sort of presidency, he always sounds like he has a clear vision of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Even though he clearly doesn't.
Yeah.
And actually, so in that sense, maybe it doesn't even matter.
No, and this goes back to the whole theme of presidentialism. I mean, I remember when I did my politics A-level sort of 20 years ago, almost, well, it wasn't 20 years ago, 15 years ago, was sort of like when Blair came along, and this idea that Blair was very much like an American president. And this idea, actually, it's all about style over substance. And what we're seeing now is just almost, in a way, a continuation of that, where Trump is basically, he's talking a sort of good talk that appeals to a certain soundbite type of politics, but the substance is obviously very lacking. But people don't think about that.
Quite clearly just styling it out, as they say.
Yeah, but obviously it seems to be working.
I mean, yeah, well, for something.
To an extent. Well, I mean, it's working in the sense that he's still in power, and it has been for quite a lot longer than nothing.
For the time being, yeah.
We accept it. But it is quite scary, isn't it? So, on to other... I was going to say brighter things, but it's not really. I wanted to talk a little bit about natural disasters that have been going on across the world. Obviously, we've got the ongoing climate change debates, which is still a debate in some quarters, I think. Then we've had these other disasters. So we've had the Amazon fires, which I think have been massively underreported, I think.
Certainly in Europe, I think.
In Europe, I mean, considering the impact on the globe. And more smaller events have also sort of been quite significant, in such as we had the fire at Notre Dame as well this year. So where do we want to start with these disasters?
Well, so one of the things that gave me pause for thought, should I say, sort of when the Amazon fires were being reported, the fifth item on the news or whatever, despite the fact that these are hugely globally significant, one of the things that sort of came up, because it was earlier in the year, wasn't it, when sort of they were actually on the news, and a few people sort of said, oh, why can't we just tell Brazil what to do? And from someone who studied international law, that seemed so strange, actually, the idea that people would try to overrule a country's sovereignty it's not for themselves, is it? It's
for the greater good.
For the greater good, yeah. But obviously, in international law, the idea of each state is sovereign and you shouldn't interfere with another state is like the founding idea.
Yeah, but they're on like one of the world's most important resources, and you've got to say they've not been taking these things seriously enough. And I mean, maybe the fact that we didn't intervene has been an issue with the fact that obviously Trump's been in charge in the US, probably doesn't care about the environment so much as maybe another.
Absolutely, and I think that's sort of a trend that sort of seems to be goes along with these sort of authoritarian light regimes. or in some cases fully authoritarian, because Bolsonaro in Brazil doesn't give a shit about the Amazon.
Mm.
In fact, he's quite happy to get rid of it.
Mm.
Trump doesn't even think climate change is real.
They see it as a resource, don't they?
Exactly, the
Amazon. But it is a resource, but in a very different way to the way people sort of treat it.
Yeah, I think maybe it's linked to the idea of the market will solve all our problems.
Mm.
Because if eventually the market realises that climate change is terrible, then they'll do something about it. But of course, as everybody really knows, the market is not all-seeing and all-powerful and all-knowing.
No, and I wonder if maybe there's also a problem where this international law thing, where we don't feel like we've got the power to go in and do something about it.
Well, we don't.
Well, we don't, no. But at the same time, someone really does need to take control and sort of... This is the Amazon rainforest. This is incredibly significant. I feel probably the most significant story, perhaps, of this year, in my own view at least. And that we didn't really do anything about it. And it's just absolutely terrible, I think. Mm. That someone couldn't just go, okay, right, we need to... As a collective group, we, Europe... I mean, we could talk about Europe and the sort of... the actual power Europe has or doesn't have later on, but as a collective humanity, why we couldn't just all get together and say, okay, right, we're going to send a load of planes and we're going to sort this out. We're going to, well, when I say planes, I mean sort of dropping water on them, and you know, but we do, but I mean, this is fundamental to our ongoing existence as a species, and it's just like I don't feel like people care.
Yeah, I mean, it's the closest thing to an existential threat that probably humanity has faced this year.
Yeah, I mean, we've had quite a few, let's be fair.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is that in order to, what should we say? Yeah, I'll say get away with going intervening in another country, you either need to be an absolute hegemon international power, as the US was, you know, a few years ago, a la Iraq 2003, or you need the country itself to accept it. Bolsonaro's never going to do that. Or you basically need the UN to turn into an authoritarian world government.
The UN probably should have done something. I think maybe it would have been the UN's responsibility to get involved there. Because what else is the UN for?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, well, this is the thing. That's another debate, isn't it? What is the UN for?
Yeah, especially with the anniversary of the UN recently, actually.
I mean, a lot of people say it's just a talking shop for countries to get together, whereas other people want it to be a much more robust organisation fighting for humanity as a whole.
Yeah, well, it probably needs to be a little bit less conservative with a small c, because that would have probably been the ideal platform with which to interview and say, okay, right, we need to step in here and actually put some boots on the ground to sort this fire situation out, because it threatens all of us indirectly.
Yeah, I mean, this is what should I say? So there's an idea around there are certain circumstances where in international law, where sort of exceptional measures can be taken, and so I'm thinking about where people try and legitimise things like humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect. The thing is that what tends to happen is that as soon as you create an exceptional measure, and everybody understands the exceptional measure,
it becomes a norm.
It becomes a norm.
Yeah,
and it ceases to be exceptional almost straight away, and then because it ceases to be exceptional, people then begin to sort of toy with it around the edges, and the how it could be used sort of becomes to expand. So me and the classic case in terms of responsibility protects and sort of going in to save people who are being abused by their own government is Libya, where, you know, it very quickly turned into regime change. So that's the great fear, and why the UN Security Council basically never ever authorised a sort of intervention in a country ever again, probably, or until something drastic happens, is because how can that power be abused in the future?
I mean, it's part of the problem here that this idea that the politics are different in a way, that we create this sense that states are different and they've got this individual sovereignty, but actually we need to start thinking more on a sort of species existence level here.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I've sort of realised has been forgotten, is when there was that sort of march in Charlottesville by the far right in support of Trump. There was an article by somebody whose name I can't remember about how we have to be intolerant to intolerance. Sort of got spread and became quite viral, and then everyone seems to have forgotten about it since then. But in the same, and the sort of the reasoning behind this idea was that intolerant views are always negative. There is no positive upside. There is no upside to an intolerant view. part for the community as a whole. Part, there are upsides, but only on an individual level.
Mm.
If you are basically the same as the people who are, if you're a person who's going to benefit from an intolerant view, so say it's a white supremacist group who are spouting intolerant views, and you're white, and you can basically benefit from that intolerance.
Mm.
Whereas for the rest of society, it's entirely negative, and that negative will always outweigh how it can benefit a small number of people.
Mm.
So basically, the article was suggesting that we need to be intolerant of intolerant views because it's better for the whole. So maybe then we should become intolerant of views that are anti-humanist, are going to be detrimental to the human race.
Or, to take it one step further, should we become intolerant of tolerance? Insofar as we are tolerating like Brazil's behaviour in this case because we don't want to upset it, sort of tip the apple cart. But really, maybe we should have gone, we need to stop, wait a minute, right, enough of this farting around with international politics, right, this is the entire human species we're thinking about here. We need to actually get together and do something about this.
Yeah, that's the same.
It's the same thing, but in a different frame, in a slightly different way.
I suppose the thing is that the fact that we're considering this highlights the thing that we've just said about the sort of the softness of culture towards authoritarianism at the moment.
Mm.
So that we're quite happy to discuss the idea of an authoritarian global government because it could save humanity. But of course, the problem is what happens when other issues come up.
I mean, is one of the factors here the fact that we're all still living in the shadow of the Cold War, and we're all a little bit worried that some massive war might break out as a result of these things?
Maybe.
So that's why we're sort of pussyfooting around some of these issues that maybe need to be dealt with on a sort of human level.
Yeah, I think, because I mean, when you think about what's the approach to whether AI is going to be a threat or not, it's kind of, is it a threat or not? Let's use it for the benefit of humankind. Is climate change going to be a threat to humankind? Not like, oh, let's do something about it so we can all prosper and we can all be fulfilled.
Mm.
It seems to be that there's an attitude in, not just in international politics, I think probably in national politics as well, where it's about, let's try and win.
Mm. It's about being in power.
It's about let's win for our side, not let's...
Yeah.
Let's collaborate and we can have a win-win situation.
Yeah.
So there we go.
And that's been the factor in British politics, American politics, all sorts across the globe, really.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously we could also mention the Hong Kong sort of riot protests, which have been going on, which have been quite sad to see. Not sad to see the protests, but sad to see what's been going on there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the way sort of the Hong Kongese people have been treated.
Yeah, I think Hong Kong is kind of... what's really fascinating, actually, is that you can draw a clear line between what's been happening, the protests and the leaders of the protests in Hong Kong and kind of the failures of the Occupy movement.
Mm.
And also to the sort of Arab Spring as well. Because what a lot of things that sort of happened in the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, they were sort of decentralized resistance to the actions of power, which they didn't like, which they felt were terrible, and that's why they protested, right? But the fact that they were so decentralized meant that, so they sort of organized on Facebook and Twitter and whatever, and there were no clear leaders. And this was seen as a strength because then these movements could morph and change as was necessary to be in opposition. But of course, that was also a weakness because it meant that people weren't really strong in any area.
Mm.
Whereas in Hong Kong, you see this movement being decentralized and, you know, being amorphous and changing, and people turning up to protest because a thing went out on Twitter. Because everyone knows that's what, everyone sees it and everyone goes and protests. But it's around a central issue. It's around democracy in Hong Kong and in opposition to the takeover by the Chinese mainland and the Chinese Communist Party. So maybe that's how it's become a stronger movement, because that's a clear red line for the movement, for everybody in it.
Mm.
Not like, so with Occupy, you know, there would have been people who wanted to tear down capitalism, there were people who just wanted a job, wanted public services to function well. So there's kind of these different levels and these different ideologies within sort of an occupy movement as it was.
It's quite broad, isn't it?
Yeah, so, a broad church.
Quite amorphous, yeah, in a bad way, in a sense, because there's nothing to tie yourself to.
There's no sort of central strength to it.
No.
Whereas with the Hong Kong sort of protests, you see this kind of this central pillar of democracy and Democracy Now.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of its strength, isn't it? And what you also see, because it's such a united movement, what's really interesting is that you can see people turn up, you know, these protests are announced on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and they say non-violence. And according to what comes through the news, there isn't any, if they say that's what's going to happen. And, I mean, maybe it seems... As it's sort of gone on for a few months, it seems more like the more hardcore protests have become started to engage in violence, and the Hong Kong police have responded.
I mean, this is quite interesting because it ties with a previous podcast on who the good guys in war, where I think especially in this case, because the point that they're making is that it's all about the non-violence because they're trying to show how democratic they are versus this sort of authoritarian regime shutting them down, which is very sort of. Which is again, they need to be seen because that is part of the fundamental ethos of the movement. I mean, you can see what might happen because I mean, you see the pictures of these fights and the way these police are treating them. It's quite sort of terrible to see, really.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think kind of the central pillar of the movement being around democracy and special treatment for Hong Kong sort of seems to be a strength for it in a way that other protest movements of the 21st century don't.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there a cultural thing as well? Maybe is that an issue?
I don't think I know enough about Hong Kong to comment on that. Really.
No, I wonder to what extent are we maybe also responsible as the British. I mean, we sort of essentially, dare I say, abandoned them.
Well, I mean, I think because the thing is that in the agreement where the British left Hong Kong, that sort of set up this one state, two systems idea.
Yeah,
and accepted that in 50 years it will become one state, one system. So, I think you could say that in the fact that upon leaving, kind of the British did accept that Hong Kong would lose its special status rather than.
But we accepted that on behalf of the Hong Kongese people. They've obviously now got to put up with it.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? It's Hong Kongers don't want to put up with it.
No.
Why would they and why should they?
No, I mean, it's an ongoing situation, and obviously we can talk about it more maybe as things develop. So, I mean, for the sort of the final third, maybe, of the podcast, I thought maybe we could talk about some of the technological developments, things that have been happening this year outside of the awful things in politics and national disasters. I was thinking maybe, we've seen, obviously, a continuation in sort of streaming, subscription culture. We've had the launch of new TV channels with Disney Plus and sort of Apple TV, trying to compete now with Netflix. We've also got... electric cars, the movement continuing to varying levels of success. Elon Musk has announced his truck, his electronic truck. Looks like something from a sci-fi movie. And we've got private space travel as well, which is starting to take off, literally.
Yeah, I mean, just to comment on the truck, I saw a famous petrol head has bought an electronic car. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
And his classic Hummer. He has now bought an electronic Hummer.
Has he really? Yes. I mean, how heavy would that be to move that weighty beast?
But I mean, I suppose it shows that, the Tesla truck and the Hummer electric sort of shows that this is not a fringe idea anymore.
No.
It is a central idea to the future of automobiles.
Well, the need to sort of be more sustainable, yes. I mean... You could argue that perhaps there are some flaws with it. I mean, sort of charging points, length of time to charge, the weight of the batteries. Personally, I would suggest maybe hydrogen is actually the actual solution.
Yeah, I think everyone accepts that, really, don't they?
I mean, I don't know, because I don't know if general members of the public know enough about it. But it's good to see that people are thinking more environmentally. Whether the electric cars is going to really make an environmental difference is another matter.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is sort of 10 years ago, people would say... Electric cars aren't going to do anything because ultimately you've got to plug them in and that power comes from a power station, which, 10, 15 years ago, it was coal, oil, gas-fired, right? Whereas actually we've seen a significant increase in wind farms, particularly offshore wind farms.
Yeah.
Increases in ability of solar batteries and solar storage. So I think actually it's whereas 10, 15 years ago, the electric car was basically still a problem because where its original power source came from, or its energy source. Whereas now it's not quite so much of a problem.
No.
And I think if the current trends continue, then actually it'll be all right.
Yeah,
But that's the problem is, will these trends continue? Because there's only so much space where you can put
charge these
wind
cars.
farm, well, wind farms
Yeah.
and solar cells and all that type of thing.
And when these things become more expensive, because I think at the moment some people have benefited from sort of free charging or cheap or particularly cheap charging, when they get to be charged the sort of legitimate price for what they're taking, I mean that will start to cause issues. And then you've got other problems with sort of maintenance of these cars, disposal of batteries. I mean that's a big one that looms on the horizon in sort of 30, 40 years' time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Note that down, everyone. Mike's prophecies.
Well, I suppose another issue is that batteries sort of decay all the time. I mean,
Over time.
they don't hold as much charge.
No.
People sort of see this with their mobile phones all the time. You buy it and it lasts for 2 days, and then a year later it lasts for a day and a half, and then after that it lasts for 6 hours or something.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing because it's we learn this in sort of A-level physics. It's like the elastic band. So you have an elastic band and you stretch it. But if you keep on doing it over time, the stretchiness wears out eventually, and that's exactly what happens with batteries. And that is one of the issues of many with electric cars. Not that I'm saying electric cars are bad, but I'm saying that there are some big problems to be overcome.
But I mean, I think it feels like that's the best option for most people at the moment.
Yeah, and the distance that people travel, I think, as well. I think obviously range is a concern, but often as well, people we don't travel as much as they think they do.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ideas around solving the range problem that I quite liked was the idea that you basically wouldn't own your battery. You would go to, well, I was going to say, well, not a petrol station, but a service station. And you would basically take out the battery from your car,
Swap
you
them
would
over.
swap it over for a full one, and you would
Yeah.
leave one that was yours there to charge. And basically, then batteries become this sort of societal resource.
Yeah, I mean that does make sense. That would require a lot of effort to have cars that are all similar using the same
Exactly,
systems.
absolutely.
The other thing that came to my mind, it goes right back to our very first couple of podcasts about autonomous cars, is maybe the other option is actually to move to a model of sort of collective ownership.
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose universal basic services idea. So the idea of universal basic income is quite a big popular idea at the moment, particularly with Andrew Yang being a US presidential candidate in the US. He suggests the idea that the state should basically pay everybody in the country sort of a universal basic income, a certain amount every month. So that, I think the idea is that it's enough to barely survive, so that if you lost your job, you would have a clear safety net. Whereas, but yeah, because the problem is that it needs to be large enough for you to live on, but low enough that you wouldn't just abandon all work.
Yeah, I mean, the technology is not there yet, but I'm thinking, obviously, I own a car, you've got a car outside.
Yeah.
Most of the time, though, that car's not in use. So now, for example, your car's parked outside. You wouldn't have your car. Basically, your car would now drive off to
Oh,
pick
I
up
see what
someone
you mean. I see
else.
what you mean. Yeah.
I mean, this is another version. So essentially, when you want to leave, you sort of call a taxi almost, and it'll be just the car that's nearest that's available to you that'll come and.
So for listeners who don't realise where I was going, an alternative to universal basic income is called universal basic services, and that idea is that travel things like travel, train travel, bus travel, energy, lighting, water, all your amenities should be paid for by the state as an alternative to universal basic income. But yeah, there is this idea of autonomous vehicles in that if because most people's cars don't, most of the time they sit idle, not doing anything. So actually, yeah, why not own cars anymore? And we basically like subscribe to Uber, like Uber style services, where an autonomous car will turn up whenever we tap the app.
But obviously that would require a massive cultural shift because obviously the fact we own cars is part of the sort of mythology of which we've sort of grown up in, isn't it? You have to own these things are yours, and it's yours to do with what you like. Obviously we need to change the way we think about the world and things. I think it's a long way off yet. Again, we'll put this down in Mike's prophecies for sort of 50 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I always think about it is that you would kind of have to have a lot of these cars available, because there's clearly going to be events where a lot of people will need a car and will want to go somewhere, to the same place. Whereas most of the time, it will be a much lower level of need.
Well, you'd have some sort of planned transport system, yeah. I guess, where, because you wouldn't have them all travelling at the same time. You'd have to have an arranged pick-up, drop-off point, perhaps. You could share cars as well. So, you drive here, there are four other seats in your car. Yeah. There are probably other people coming to this part of the world. I mean, it would be like a sort of taxi service where people just sort of hop in, hop out.
Yeah, I think there's Uber Pool, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I can see that being a case. But even still, I mean, there's probably like maybe sort of 50 cars parked on this road. None of them are being used. They're just sort of parked here for sake. I mean, instead of having 50 cars, there might be 5 cars in circulation. Mm. That would be always on the move.
Resources-wise.
But I mean, we're now sort of futures thinking here. Quite a bit more than we perhaps anticipated. But I think the electric car thing is a big thing that's becoming more prevalent, more important.
Absolutely, yeah. And long may it continue, I think.
Yeah, well, as long as it helps with this environment issues.
Yeah, until hydrogen power can take over.
Yeah, so I mean, we've talked about some of the big issues that have come up over this last year. So just to wrap up, I mean, what do we think is going to be the big thing in 2020?
I don't think anyone can predict it in terms of politics.
No.
At all, I don't think.
I mean, because for all we know, we could be doing this podcast in a year's time. Trump could have been impeached. We might still be in the European Union. We might not be in the European Union. Who knows?
Exactly.
Will the European Union even exist?
For some people think we'll be at war with Russia, don't they?
In its current form, yeah. So, I mean, politics, obviously, we can't predict. Climate change is still going to be a big issue, I think. More natural disasters.
It can't be turned around in a year, can it?
No.
But hopefully, you know, there's definitely a tangible movement that to obviously acknowledge climate change. I acknowledge that it's man-made. And, you know, be more environmentally aware and do things.
Mm.
You know, I keep saying 10, 15 years ago, but really the world has changed in that long. You know, 10, 15 years ago, if you recycled, you were sort of a green weirdo.
Mm.
You know, who bothered to recycle? Now, it's not only is it de rigueur, but you will be shamed if you don't. And rightly so, I think. Mm. So yeah, I think there's definitely something more tangible and more significant about the green movement.
Mm.
And I think, because I mean, you know, I mean, the most recent Labour election campaign talks about a Green New Deal.
Mm.
Well, previous elections, the idea of a green anything was restricted solely to the Green Party.
Yeah, I mean, the Green Party are still seen maybe as being the outsider weirdos, but it is becoming a more important issue where people are actually asking to see the leaders of the big two parties talk about green issues.
I mean, there was a specific debate about climate change, wasn't there, hosted by Channel 4?
Yeah, exactly.
Boris decided not to turn up to.
Yeah. But, anyway. But I mean, politics aside, I mean, green issues are going to continue to be carrying on. I mean, we've got technology, we've got the rise of electric cars, subscription services, we've got the big corporations battling it out for our time and our money.
Yeah, I think to me, it's in terms of technology, I think I'm starting to feel like there's hints around people are beginning to sort of be pushed to the limit in terms of what they'll accept in terms of like algorithmic control.
Right.
So, you know, people sort of are becoming very aware about how their data is being used by these large corporations, how they're being manipulated in terms of, you know, the psychological effects of, say, being on social media and seeing all these people publicise there how apparently great their lives are, feeling like shit because you don't feel your life is like that.
Mm.
So I think people are becoming more aware that these sorts of social media services do that to them, and the services themselves actively encourage you to stay and you know, and look through all these
fear of missing out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think people are becoming more aware of it, and hopefully that means that people will become more critical of their engagement with it.
Yeah, I mean, do we think then that maybe we've seen peak social media? Maybe is 2019 the tipping point? Are we going to start? Are they going to start losing numbers?
This is the thing. It feels like there's something happening.
Yeah,
but this might just be the people who I'm listening to. It might only be a small contingent, but or maybe it's kind of, you know, lots of trends. There's kind of a vanguard who does something, and then the largest sort of change happens later. So maybe I kind of hope so, because I mean, obviously, in our Christmas episode, we talked about how there's kind of been a loss of meaningful engagement between people. You know, I was speaking to a relative of mine who runs a company. And they were saying that lots of their new hires, you know, don't really communicate very well because all of their communication skills, or the vast majority of their communication skills, are now based about being online and being...
Well, social media means of communication.
Yeah, so rather than interpersonal. And so I would kind of, I'm kind of hoping that, this is... 2020 is going to be the year of the change in terms of social media. Because actually, yeah, I think it seems to be... There seems to be a growing acknowledgement that what we get from social media is not entirely... Well, definitely it's not entirely positive.
Mm.
And for the vast majority of people, the negatives kind of outweigh the positives. Because if you... I mean, the positives about social media are that you learn about new events, you connect with people you haven't seen for a while, and you feel part of the community, and those are all great. But if you feel like shit at the same time because you've not got players to watch, or you've not got a new car, or you're, as you said in the last episode, you're someone, the person who posts before or after you on Instagram about their Christmas presents has got a bigger pile than you, then I think people are starting to realise that. It's not the be all and end all, and if you miss a few days or you miss a long time, actually it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously there are habitual issues here where I think we get used to looking at these things even if there's nothing on it. I mean, I still look at social media all the time even though I don't really post in it at all.
Yeah.
Because I suppose I've become habituated to it, and it's just something that I use to distract myself. And as you say, I mean, the amount of productivity hours lost through social media, I think it's going to continue to be an issue. And it'll be something going forward in 2020 as well.
I think people are certainly starting to think more critically about it.
Mm.
Then there's are they actually going to do anything?
No.
So that's the question.
So who's going to lead this? Is it going to be the people, or is it going to be the technology?
Well, but I think the thing is that if you want to start a movement, you kind of have to be on social media. So it's kind of difficult to have an anti-social media movement without being on social media.
Because that requires people interacting and doing things of their own accord. Yeah. Well, I think there's lots to think about
For
2020. It's been a difficult 2019, I think, I would say. I think it's not necessarily been a stellar year for the world.
Not quite.
But maybe, hopefully, 2020 will be better.
Onwards and upwards.
Onwards and upwards. And onwards and upwards with the podcast as well.
Absolutely.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.